during the gubernatorial debates, during any kind of midterm conversations in the state of New York, there's no meaningful contention with this issue. And I think that it's part and parcel to why we have these crises, these concurring crises, like the mental health crisis and like the homelessness crisis. And one thing I do also want to uplift when we're thinking about the long-term future of this city and its people, what story are we telling to the 100,000 children that are experiencing homelessness right now, because many of them are aware that they're homeless, that we're scapegoating people experiencing homelessness for every violent thing that happens in the city, that we're not actually moving in loving, caring, and compassionate ways, that we're not trying to problem solve at the root, and instead we're using these narratives and these frameworks that produce vigilantes. For instance, we think about the number of people experiencing homelessness, especially street homelessness, that have been killed in the last couple of years, in the last 3 years, in Chinatown, across our city. Think about
the kind of
self-deprecation that happens.
Well, we want to thank you both for being with us. Jawanza Williams, Director of Organizing at Vocal New York, and Jumani Williams, the New York City Public Advocate. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Nina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Ndura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Asti, Joe John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Fighting for survival is such a boring battle. Wanna get into my car, I wanna drive out to Seattle, where the used record stores have much better prices, but I don't have a car.
You're and listening I don't to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio is listener-sponsored. That's right. 80% of our funding comes from donations from listeners just like you. You can always make a donation to help keep KBOO independent and non-commercial at kboo.fm/give. Right now, during our end-of-year drive, is the perfect time to contribute. Give now and help us reach our goal of $70,000 by December 31st. Make your tax-deductible year-end donation at kboo.fm/give today.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News, a warning to our local community about the dangers of respiratory viruses that are putting a big burden on local hospital emergency rooms. Expert weigh in on the biggest surprises of the November election in Oregon. And a hometown hero who helps people with dementia wins a big honor. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 1st, 2022. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, and we'd like to encourage you to become a member by going online to KBOO, to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. In Oregon and Washington, local healthcare leaders are sounding the alarm about an especially bad respiratory illness season already shaping up. They say a combined triple threat includes RSV, COVID-19, and the flu, and that patients are rapidly filling local emergency rooms. Here's part of what Clark County Health Director Dr. Alan Melnick has to say about it.
In Clark County, we're seeing a significant increase in respiratory illness, and it's gotten to the point where it's really having an impact on our local urgent care facilities and hospitals, and they're becoming overwhelmed. And the number of cases is like a triple whammy here. We've got COVID-19, which is kind of a decrease, but it's still maintaining a level we can talk about. And of course, that's underreported because of over-the-counter tests. But now we're also seeing, and we've been seeing for a while, RSV, respiratory syncytial virus, as well as influenza activity. Influenza activity recently is increasing substantially. So we define the flu season by when more than 10% of tests that are done at providers or at EDs are positive for influenza. A couple of weeks ago, we were at 9%. And then last week, 25% of tests were came back positive. And preliminary data, I can't give you the exact number, but preliminary data this week show that it's increased, it's probably increased substantially since then. So flu is going up really quickly. So it looks like we're gonna define that we're in the flu season now, and then you add that to COVID-19 and RSV, and it's kind of like a perfect storm. So the emergency department visits for suspected cases of RSV have also increased. They began increasing in September, and that's earlier than it's increased in pre-pandemic years. So we haven't been exposed to these other viruses over the last couple of years because of the measures that were taken during the pandemic. So now we're seeing an early severe flu, what looks like going to become a more severe flu season, as well as RSV increasing earlier than we've seen before. So the local urgent care clinics and our hospital emergency departments are now seeing record number of patients. And this is putting pressure not only in the emergency departments, but also we're reaching and getting beyond hospital capacity. So one of the reasons for having this news conference here is to really get out the measure to the message to the public and encourage people, if you don't have an emergency health issue, visit your doc, visit your primary care provider, your primary care physician, or go to an urgent care clinic so we can relieve the pressure on the emergency departments. I mean, the emergency rooms will still treat people who visit, but this is overwhelming them.
That was Clark County Health Director Dr. Alan Melnick. He advises people who could expose us most at risk to wear masks indoors again. All Oregon cities and some counties finally have more control over setting their own speed limits. KBOO's Josh Salem tells us more.
All Oregon cities and two counties now have something local officials have wanted for a long time, the right to manage their own internal speed limits. The Oregon Department of Transportation, or ODOT, said this week that the 241 cities, as well as Multnomah and Clackamas counties, can set some of their own speed limits without needing state approval. Before this decision, ODOT controlled all requests to change speed limits. If a locale wanted a modification, they had to make a request to the ODOT Speed Zone Review Panel. That process could take up to 12 months to get through red tape, because ODOT had only 5 engineers statewide qualified to investigate requests. Then, at the end of the process, the state traffic engineer made the final decision on whether or not the request should be granted. Sometimes state and local engineers had different opinions regarding what speeds were appropriate. Portland has been lobbying for this change for more than 10 years. In 2009, the Portland Bureau of Transportation Commissioner Sam Adams asked that cities have that control. Significant progress toward the change finally came in 2020, and the following year, House Bill 3055 passed. HB 3055 is an omnibus transportation bill that included the language to enact a new speed limit designation process. ODOT spent several months following approval, translating the new language and law into corresponding administrative rules. They also worked toward clarifying the process local road agencies must go through to change speed limits. The new rules do not directly apply to statutory speed limits. Those are governed by state law and include things like the 20-mile-per-hour limit in school zones and the 65-mile-per-hour rule seen on most interstate highways. Designated speed limits are flexible, depending on what an engineer deems is appropriate for their setting. The new authority does award the ability to change the designated speeds. If a statutory speed limit is deemed inappropriate under the new law, a designated speed limit can be established through an engineering study. A local road authority wanting to change speed limits starts by notifying their state highway engineer. They must participate in training provided by ODOT, designate one qualified registered professional engineer to be responsible for decision-making and assuring all methods and procedures in this rule are followed, and prepare and submit a quality control plan for assuring compliance with program rules and procedures. ODOT said the new system is expected to be of particular help in communities of color, which are often affected more by highway crashes. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
The wildfire seasons of the last few years have shown us the importance of trying to protect communities in the Northwest. Now, as Eric Galatis reports, engineers say it's time to move power lines underground to limit the risks of sparks, but a big barrier is the cost.
The nation is beefing up its power grids for the transition to fueling everything from cars to home cooling systems with electricity and addressing hazards along the way. Engineers say they're ready to implement a common sense solution for stopping the sparks from power lines that have led to destructive wildfires, including the one that burned down the entire town of Paradise, California. Paul Schanowski with the climate consulting firm Resilient Analytics says burying distribution lines underground would essentially eliminate the risk of sparking wildfires.
Most people would agree that other than places where you have very high flood danger, that's a great option. Why aren't we doing it when other countries are? Bottom line, cost. Who's going to pay for it?
Schanowski calls President Joe Biden's infrastructure legislation a good start, but with the price of undergrounding power lines at $4 million per mile or more, much more will be needed to reconfigure power distribution, especially across vast expanses in Colorado and other western states. Schanowski points to successful federal efforts that brought electricity to rural America for the first time in the 1930s as one potential way forward. He says the cost of damage from wildfires, lost homes and other structures, the health impacts of dangerous air quality, and the long-term impacts on watersheds far outweighs any upfront investment to move power lines underground.
The Marshall Fire, that was a huge event. It's not going to be the last one. There is no question that the investment long term will be less than the amount we would pay in rebuilding after disaster events.
According to state officials, Colorado's core fire seasons are 78 days longer on average than they were in the 1970s, a situation made more dire by rising temperatures, prolonged drought, and blasting winds. Schanowski says what gets lost in hyper-partisan debates around infrastructure investments is the fact that power lines can spark wildfires in any neighborhood, regardless of political affiliation.
We lose the focus that this is ultimately a public safety issue, and we're talking about trying to save people's lives. We need to focus on that again.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
The midterm elections brought some predictable results, but also some surprises. Alex Zelensky is the news editor of the Portland Mercury and offered her insight into what surprised her the most was Portlanders' response to government reform that was on the ballot.
But I think it's worth underscoring, you know, to be honest, yeah, I was pretty surprised that the city charter reform package passed so easily in Portland. Almost, I think, 20% difference between those in opposition and those in support. And there was a huge coalition of folks behind it, including a sitting city councilor, you know, deep-pocketed folks throwing money kind of at the movement to create an alternative to the charter reform, proposing something on the horizon that could be something maybe more appealing to the proposal going forward. And it was confusing. It was, I mean, frankly, as a reporter, it was a lot to unpack, and a lot of it was placed on kind of the media to unpack that. And so I do think that was, for me, the most surprising. And even looking back now, you know, right when it passed, it was one of the, I feel like it was called pretty early in the night on November 8th. And that to me was surprising. I was expecting it to be kind of one of those last close calls. But I think it does reflect how hungry Portlanders are for change. You know, they saw opportunity on the ballot to overhaul the entire form of government, and they took it.
And that was Portland Mercury news editor Alex Zelensky speaking at a recent League of Women Voters post-election recap. Tom Oliver is a volunteer in Washington State with a project that provides tracking devices to people who have dementia. As Eric Tegedoff reports, he's been honored with a prestigious award.
A Bellingham man who supports people with dementia has received one of the most prestigious awards for volunteerism in Washington State. The Washington Andrus Award for Community Service recognizes volunteers who are age 50 and older. This year, AARP Washington has selected Tom Oliver, lead volunteer of Project Lifesaver for Dementia Support Northwest. The project provides tracking devices for people with dementia, and Oliver works with the Whatcom County Sheriff's Department, which is able to track the devices. He says people with dementia can take off at any moment, so it's great to be able to ease the burden on their caregivers.
This program does give us the ability to find the missing person very quickly, like half an hour, instead of 12 to 16 hours like a conventional people search.
Oliver says he traveled more than 3,000 miles last year to deliver these devices and provide maintenance for them. About 35% of Washington State residents volunteer, according to AmeriCorps. Marguerite Rowe is the AARP Washington State Director. She says the Andrus Award is given to people who give back to their communities.
The Andrus Award recipient this year, Tom Oliver, is an exceptional volunteer in what he has provided to his community, but also he serves as a role model for others of what can be accomplished.
The Andrus Award for Community Service is named after AARP founder Dr. Ethel Percy Andrus. For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. We'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, Paradigms featuring Music is Medicine. Tonight's weather, partly cloudy skies, down to an overnight low of 27. Tomorrow's weather, considerable cloudiness with occasional rain showers in the afternoon, a high of 43. Today in history, on this date in 1955, Rosa Parks was jailed for refusing to give up her seat on a public bus to a white man, a violation of Montgomery, Alabama's racial segregation laws. Our quote of the day is from Rosa Parks. To bring about change, you must not be afraid to take the first step. We will fail when we fail to try. The House passed a bill to avoid a crippling railroad strike. Hakeem Jeffries is chosen to lead House Democrats. And President Biden promises more federal Native American engagement at the Tribal Nations Summit. With more on the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Mr. Speaker, I rise today to stand full force behind the rail workers of our nation and those of my home state of Ohio. Rail workers deserve our thanks and respect for the back-breaking work they do 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
The U.S. House passed a bill 290-137 Wednesday to force railroad unions to accept a bargaining agreement and divert a crippling strike. There is a push in the Senate to include a sick leave provision, but the Biden administration doubts it will pass. Hakeem Jeffries was elected as the new House Democratic leader and promised the caucus will work for the people and ensure the voices of their constituents are heard. Jeffries added he is seeking bipartisan cooperation when possible.
We look forward to finding opportunities to partner with the other side of the aisle and work with them whenever possible. But we will also push back against extremism whenever necessary.
Earlier this week, Stuart Rhodes, the founder of the Oath Keepers, was found guilty of seditious conspiracy for his part in the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Attorney General Merrick Garland said more must be done.
As the verdict of this case makes clear, the department will work tirelessly to hold accountable those responsible for crimes related to the attack on our democracy on January 6, 2021.
Garland added the Justice Department is working to uncover the legal missteps which led to the neglect of Jackson, Mississippi's water system. At the White House's Tribal Nations Summit, President Joe Biden said he intends to provide Native Americans a stronger voice in federal issues.
Federal agencies should strive to reach consensus among the tribes. And there should be adequate time for ample communication. Federal agencies should prepare a public record for what's transpired during those consultations, and tribal nations should know how their contributions influence the decision-making.
As the legislative session nears an end, House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy spoke about his goals, adding while he would like to work in a bipartisan manner, he believes the new Republican House majority will advance GOP priorities.
I can work with anyone who's willing to work to get our spending under control, to work to make America energy independent, to secure our borders. CRs are not where we want to be, But if we cannot get our work done now, the outgoing majority, if they don't want to work with us, we can get this work done in January as well.
I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You may remember the 2020 Iowa caucuses were beset with problems in the Democratic presidential primaries. Now, as Suzanne Potter reports, a neighboring state is in the running for being first in the nation.
A decision could come today on Nevada's bid to become the first state in the nation to hold a Democratic primary in 2024. The Democratic National Committee is meeting to consider whether to change the traditional order of Iowa, then New Hampshire, then South Carolina. Judith Whitmer, chair of the Nevada State Democratic Party, says Nevada delivered the Senate for the Democrats in the midterms and fits the bill as a small, diverse state that lends itself to retail politics where candidates must engage with voters in person.
That criteria is diversity and competitiveness, and also it needs to be in a media market that isn't so overpriced that candidates can't afford it coming out of the gate.
The Nevada Republican Party is expected to hold its primary on the same day as the Democrats. Governor Steve Sisolak signed a law last year instituting a statewide primary, replacing the former caucus system. No significant opposition has arisen in state, but multiple other states are vying to go first on the primary calendar, including Michigan, Minnesota, and New Hampshire. Emmanuel Leal is the communications director for Somos Votantes in Las Vegas, a group that focuses on the Latino vote.
The country does not look like Iowa. The country does not look like New Hampshire. The country looks like Nevada, a state with a diverse population of people of color, of union, of rural and urban families.
Leal notes that the state chosen to go first will garner a huge amount of national attention and political influence and will see an influx of millions in election-related spending. For Nevada News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
President Biden renews his commitment to tribal nations, and a Montana senator introduces the Native Homeless Vets Bill. With these stories and more, here's National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. President Biden on Wednesday told tribal leaders he made a commitment to tribal nations as a U.S. senator in his 30s, then when he ran for president, and is now continuing his promise to tribes as president of the United States. Biden says he's respecting nation-to-nation relationships. He made the remarks at the White House Tribal Nations Summit taking place in person in Washington, D.C. Biden says his administration has worked on strengthening relationships with tribes and has made financial investments in Indian country. He says tribes not only have a seat at the table, but also have Native American representation in key positions, including Secretary of the Interior, Deb Haaland.
On my watch, we're ushering in a new era and advancing a way for the federal government to work with tribal nations. And it starts by appointing Native Americans to lead the front lines of my administration. You know, starting with Secretary Haaland, We followed dozens of Senate-confirmed Native American officials, over 60 Native American appointees all across my administration, including in the federal courts.
Biden says he also restored the White House Council on Native American Affairs to improve coordination with federal agencies and tribes. The administration is making a number of announcements this week relating to its work in Indian country, from sacred site protection to measures to boost economic development to Native language preservation. About 10 tribal leaders met privately with President Biden Wednesday. Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska President Richard Peterson was one of them.
It was pretty great. I actually was one of a few tribal leaders selected to meet the president, so that was pretty special.
Peterson says tribal leaders were able to have a brief moment with the president to share priorities. Peterson mentioned the taking of land into trust by the Bureau of Indian Affairs for his tribe. According to the Interior Department, that recent action is the second fee-to-trust acquisition in Alaska since the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in the 1970s, and it's the first in 5 years. The land is located in Juneau. Among things, it will help with federal services and programs and foster economic development.
So it's pretty historical, and so we're appreciative of that. Talked about some of the other issues, you know, we talked about broadband, ARPA, infrastructure. You know, it was very fast, I'm telling you.
Peterson says he's grateful to have had a moment with the president. He says under this administration, tribes are seeing more Native American and Alaska Native representation in Washington, which is helping tribes gain traction on their priorities. Vice President Kamala Harris also addressed tribal leaders Wednesday. She reiterated the nation-to-nation relationship building and the administration's commitment to tribes. The White House Tribal Nations Summit continues Thursday. Montana U.S. Senator John Tester Wednesday announced the introduction of a bill that aims to provide more support for homeless Native veterans. Aaron Bolton has more.
The bill would carve out a portion of housing vouchers for use by Indigenous vets enrolled in the VA and tribal housing authorities. The housing vouchers are offered by the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and given to vets enrolled in VA case management services. Native Americans serve in the military at higher rates compared to other racial groups, and studies indicate that Native veterans experience the highest rate of homelessness, according to the VA. The bill would also require that both the VA and HUD consult with tribes to better offer resources to homeless vets and report to Congress on the issue every 5 years. The current term of Congress is scheduled to end in the coming weeks. In Columbia Falls, I'm Aaron Bolton.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Two-thirds of American households that give to charities donate an average of 4% of their incomes. Now, as Ross Brown reports, nonprofits are hoping for a holiday charitable giving for a boost despite inflation.
Economic uncertainty created by the pandemic did not stop Americans from boosting charitable donations to record numbers in 2020 and overall giving in 2021. But with inflation, it's not clear if that will continue this year. About 20% of charitable giving occurs between today and New Year's Eve. Thomas Tighe with the humanitarian health organization Direct Relief says choosing a charity you believe in is the first step to feeling good about making a contribution.
Once you decide what it is that you care about, it's worth doing your homework to find a group that's going to do right with your money. It's going to make you feel proud. Are they meeting these transparency standards? And that's a good thing to do, just to make sure that the cause that speaks to you, your money's going to serve the cause.
Despite inflation, online Black Friday sales in the U.S. topped a record-breaking $9 billion this year, according to Adobe Analytics. Tighe believes civic engagement is ingrained in American culture, evidenced by the existence of 1.5 million charities nationwide. According to Kindness Financial Planning, individuals accounted for almost three-quarters of the $334 billion of charitable giving in 2020.
For groups that rely on charitable support, it's a time of cross your fingers and hope you did everything well, and that people are in a position to give. And that's the big unknown, what the effects of inflation are.
72% of baby boomers give to charity, compared with 60% of millennials and 59% of Gen Xers. But Tighe says younger people often give smaller amounts to groups or causes not associated with corporate workplace campaigns.
There's no sense that people who are younger care any less. I think they may engage differently in the type of giving that they do or engagement.
To make sure your contribution goes as far as possible, consumer guidance services such as Charity Navigator and the Better Business Bureau rate charities for a variety of trust factors. For Texas News Service, I'm Roz Brown. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to an end-of-year membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, December 1st, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem, Eric Tegadoff, Roz Brown, Suzanne Potter, and Eric Galatis. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K2A2BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are sponsored by our members. KBOO is currently in our end-of-year membership drive, so now's a great time to get involved. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Have a wonderful evening.
This radio show contains graphic descriptions of violence, occasional use of the N-word, and other content that some people may find disturbing or offensive.
This radio show was produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon.
Someone will call us up and say, hey, my friend works at this Pizza Hut, and this Nazi works there, and he's always fucking with her. And so we would go to the Pizza Hut, we would wait there, and when they get off work, we'd follow him home. And then follow them to another home. And then we'd stake that place out. And we would just start making connections. All of a sudden, we had this network that was all scribbled out on a notepad that had like 20 different addresses on it with the major, major hitters on their side. All the Youth of Hitler guys, Aryan Front, American Front. We had all these people's names and addresses just from following people around because we were patient. Our Friday nights would be, okay, four of us get together and we go sit out in front of the house, drink a couple beers and talk to us and listen to music and, ooh, someone's coming, here they go. Okay, let's follow them to the next house. And then when they're going to try and meet up somewhere, we can dismantle their car.